make of automobile. When I reached home, everyone was excited. Next day, the neighbors came to congratulate me. I even felt safe from Grandfather, whose deathbed curse usually spoiled my triumphs. I stood beneath his photograph with my briefcase in hand and smiled triumphantly into his stolid black peasant's face. It was a face that fascinated me. The eyes seemed to follow everywhere I went. That night, I dreamed I was at a circus with him and that he refused to laugh at the clowns, no matter what they did. Then later he told me to open my briefcase and read what was inside, and I did, finding an official envelope stamped with the state seal. And inside the envelope, I found another and another endlessly, and I thought I would fall of weariness. "Them's years," he said. "Now open that one." And I did. And in it, I found an engraved document containing a short message in letters of gold. "Read it," my grandfather said, "out loud." "To whom it may concern," I intoned, "keep this nigger boy running." I awoke with the old man's laughter ringing in my ears. It was a dream I was to remember and dream again for many years after. But at that time I had no insight into its meaning. First, I had to attend college. It was a beautiful college. The buildings were old and covered with vines, and the roads gracefully winding, lined with hedges and wild roses that dazzled the eyes in the summer sun. Honeysuckle and purple wisteria hung heavy from the trees, and white magnolias mixed with their scents in the bee-humming air. I've recalled it often here in my hole. How the grass turned green in the springtime, and how the mockingbirds fluttered their tails and sang, how the moon shone down on the buildings, how the bell in the chapel tower rang out the precious short-lived hours, how the girls in bright summer dresses promenaded the grassy lawn. Many times, here at night, I've closed my eyes and walked along the forbidden road that winds past the girls' dormitories, past the hall with the clock in the tower, its windows warmly aglow, on down past the small white home economics practice cottage, whiter still in the moonlight, and on down the road with its sloping and turning, paralleling the black powerhouse with its engines droning earth-shaking rhythms in the dark, its windows red from the glow of the furnace, on to where the road became a bridge over a dry riverbed, tangled with brush and clinging vines, the bridge of rustic logs, made for trysting, but virginal and untested by lovers. On up the road, past the buildings with the southern verandas half a city block long, to the sudden forking, barren of buildings, birds, or grass, where the road turned off to the insane asylum. I was come this far and opened my eyes. The spell breaks and I try to re-see the rabbits, so tame through having never been hunted, that played in the hedges and along the road. And I see the purple and silver of thistle growing between the broken glass and sun-heated stones, the ants moving nervously in single file, and I turn and retrace my steps and come back to the winding road past the hospital, where at night in certain wards the gay student nurses dispensed a far more precious thing than pills to lucky boys in the know, and I come to stop at the chapel. And then it is suddenly winter, with the moon high above and the chimes in the steeple ringing and a sonorous choir of trombones rendering a Christmas carol. And over all is a quietness and an ache as though all the world were loneliness. And I stand and listen beneath the high-hung moon, hearing, "A mighty fortress is our God," majestically mellow on four trombones, and then the organ. The sound floats over all, clear like the night, liquid, serene, and lonely. And I stand as for an answer and see in my mind's eye the cabins surrounded by empty fields beyond red clay roads, and beyond a certain road, a river, sluggish and covered with algae more yellow than green in its stagnant stillness, past more empty fields to the sun-shrunk shacks at the railroad crossing, where the disabled veterans visited the whores, hobbling down the tracks on crutches and canes, sometimes pushing the legless, thighless one in a red wheelchair. And sometimes I listen to hear if music reaches that far, but recall only the drunken laughter of sad, sad whores. And I stand in the circle where three roads converge near the statue, where we drilled four abreast down the smooth asphalt and pivoted and entered the chapel on Sundays, our uniforms pressed, shoes shined, minds laced up, eyes blind like those of robots to visitors and officials on the low, whitewashed reviewing stand. It's so long ago and far away that here in my invisibility, I wonder if it happened at all. Then in my mind's eye I see the bronze statue of the college founder, the cold father symbol, his hands outstretched in the breathtaking gesture of lifting a veil that flutters in hard metallic folds above the face of a kneeling slave. And I am standing puzzled, unable to decide whether the veil is really being lifted or lowered more firmly in place, whether I am witnessing a revelation, or a more efficient blinding. And as I gaze, there is a rustle of wings, and I see a flock of starlings flighting before me, and when I look again, the bronze face whose empty eyes look upon a world I have never seen runs with liquid chalk, creating another ambiguity to puzzle my groping mind. Why is a bird-soiled statue more commanding than one that is clean? Oh, long green stretch of campus. Oh, quiet songs at dusk. Oh, moon that kissed the steeple and flooded the perfumed nights. Oh, bugle that called in the morning. Oh, drum that marched us militarily at noon. What was real? What solid? What more than a pleasant, time-killing dream? For how could it have been real if now I am invisible? If real, why is it that I can recall in all that island of greenness no fountain, but one that was broken, corroded, and dry? And why does no rain fall through my recollections, sound through my memories, soak through the hard, dry crust of the still-so-recent past? Why do I recall, instead of the odor of seed bursting in springtime, only the yellow contents of the cistern spread over the lawn's dead grass? Why? And how? How and why? The grass did grow, and the green leaves appeared on the trees and filled the avenues with shadow and shade as sure as the millionaires descended from the north on Founders Day each spring. And how they arrived. Came smiling, inspecting, encouraging, conversing in whispers, speech-making into the wide-open ears of our black and yellow faces, and each leaving a sizable check as he departed. I'm convinced it was the product of a subtle magic, the alchemy of moonlight. The school, a flower-studded wasteland, the rocks sunken, the dry winds hidden, the lost crickets chirping to yellow butterflies, and oh, 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 those multi-millionaires. They were all such a part of that other life that's dead that I can't remember them all. Time was as I was, but neither that time nor that I are anymore. But this one I remember. Near the end of my junior year, I drove for him during the week he was on the campus. A face pink like St. Nicholas, topped with a shock of silk-white hair. An easy, informal manner, even with me. A Bostonian, smoker of cigars, teller of polite Negro stories. Shrewd banker, skilled scientist, director, philanthropist. 40 years, a bearer of the white man's burden, and for 60, a symbol of the great traditions. We were driving, the powerful motor purring and filling me with pride and anxiety. The car smelled of mints and cigar smoke. Students looked up and smiled in recognition as we rolled slowly past. I had just come from dinner, and in bending forward to suppress a belch, I accidentally pressed the button on the wheel, and the belch became a loud and shattering blast of the horn. Folks in the road turned and stared. "I'm awfully sorry, sir," I said, worried lest he report me to Dr. Bledsoe, the president, who had refused to allow me to drive again. "Perfectly all right. Perfectly. Where shall I drive you, sir?" "Let me see." Through the rearview mirror, I could see him studying a wafer-thin watch, replacing it in the pocket of his checked waistcoat. His shirt was soft silk, set off with a blue and white polka-dotted bow tie. His manner was aristocratic, his movements dapper and suave. "It's early to go in for the next session," he said. "Suppose you just drive. Any way you like. Have you seen all the campus, sir?" "Yes, I think so. I was one of the original founders, you know."
"Gee, I didn't know that, sir. Then I'll have to try some of the roads."
Of course I knew he was a founder, but I knew also that it was advantageous to flatter rich white folks. Perhaps he'd give me a large tip or a suit or a scholarship next year. "Anywhere else you like. The campus is part of my life, and I know my life rather well."
"Yes, sir."
He was still smiling. In a moment, the green campus with its vine-covered buildings was behind us. The car bounded over the road. How was the campus part of his life, I wondered? And how did one learn his life rather well? "Young man, you're part of a wonderful institution. It is a great dream become reality."
"Yes, sir," I said.
"I feel as lucky to be connected with it as you no doubt do yourself. I came here years ago when all your beautiful campus was barren ground. There were no trees, no flowers, no fertile farmland. That was years ago, before you were born." I listened with fascination, my eyes glued to the white line dividing the highway as my thoughts attempted to sweep back to the times of which he spoke. "Even your parents were young. Slavery was just recently passed. Your people did not know in what direction to turn, and I must confess many of mine didn't know in what direction they should turn either. But your great founder did. He was my friend, and I believed in his vision. So much so that sometimes I don't know whether it was his vision or mine." He chuckled softly, wrinkles forming at the corners of his eyes. "But of course, it was his. I only assisted. I came down with him to see the barren land and did what I could to render assistance. It has been my pleasant fate to return each spring and observe the changes that the years have wrought. That has been more pleasant and satisfying to me than my own work. It has been a pleasant fate indeed." His voice was mellow and loaded with more meaning than I could fathom. As I drove, faded and yellowed pictures of the school's early days displayed in the library flashed across the screen of my mind, coming fitfully and fragmentarily to life. Photographs of men and women in wagons drawn by mule teams and oxen dressed in black, dusty clothing, people who seemed almost without individuality. A black mob that seemed to be waiting, looking with blank faces. And among them, the inevitable collection of white men and women in smiles, clear of features, striking, elegant, and confident. Until now, and although I could recognize the founder and Dr. Bledsoe among them, the figures in the photographs had never seemed actually to have been alive, but were more like signs or symbols one found on the last pages of the dictionary. But now I felt that I was sharing in a great work, and with the car leaping leisurely beneath the pressure of my foot, I identified myself with the rich man reminiscing on the rear seat. "A pleasant fate," he repeated. "And I hope yours will be as pleasant."
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir," I said, pleased that he wished something pleasant for me.
But at the same time, I was puzzled. How could anyone's fate be pleasant? I had always thought of it as something painful. No one I knew spoke of it as pleasant, not even Woodridge, who made us read Greek plays. We were
beyond the farthest extension of the school-owned lands now, and I suddenly decided to turn off the highway down a road that seemed unfamiliar. There were no trees, and the air was brilliant. Far down the road, the sun glared cruelly against a tin sign nailed to a barn. A lone figure bending over a hoe on the hillside raised up wearily and waved, more a shadow against the skyline than a man. "How far have we come?" I heard over my shoulder.
Just about a mile, sir.
"I don't remember this section," he said. I didn't answer. I was thinking of the first person who'd mentioned anything like fate in my presence. My grandfather. There had been nothing pleasant about it, and I had tried to forget it. Now, riding here in the powerful car with this white man who was so pleased with what he called his fate, I felt a sense of dread. My grandfather would have called this treachery, and I could not understand in just what way it was. Suddenly I grew guilty at the realization that the white man might have thought so too. What would he have thought? Did he know that Negroes like my grandfather had been freed during those days just before the college had been founded? As we came to a side road, I saw a team of oxen hitched to a broken-down wagon, the ragged driver dozing on the seat beneath the shade of a clump of trees.
"Did you see that, sir?"
I asked over my shoulder.
"What was it?"
"The ox team, sir."
"Oh,
no. I can't see it for the trees," he said, looking back. "It's good timber."
I'm sorry, sir. Shall I turn back?"
"No, it isn't much," he said. "Go on." I drove on, remembering the lean, hungry face of the sleeping man. He was the kind of white man I feared. The brown fields swept out to the horizon. A flock of birds dipped down, circled, swung up and out as though linked by invisible strings. Waves of heat danced above the engine hood. The tires sang over the highway. Finally, I overcame my timidity and asked him,
"Sir, why did you become interested in the school?"
"I think," he said, thoughtfully, raising his voice, "it was because I felt, even as a young man, that your people were somehow closely connected with my destiny. Do you understand?"
"Not so clearly, sir," I said, ashamed to admit it.
"You have studied Emerson, haven't you?"
"Emerson, sir?"
"Ralph Waldo Emerson?" I was embarrassed because I hadn't.
"Not yet, sir. We haven't come to him yet."
"No?" he said with a note of surprise. "Well, never mind. I am a New Englander, like Emerson. You must learn about him, for he was important to your people. He had a hand in your destiny."
"Yes.
Perhaps that is what I mean. I had a feeling that your people were somehow connected with my destiny, that what happened to you was connected with what would happen to me." I slowed the car, trying to understand. Through the glass, I saw him gazing at the long ash of his cigar, holding it delicately in his slender, manicured fingers.
"Yes.
You are my fate, young man. Only you can tell me what it really is. Do you understand?"
"I think I do, sir."
"I mean that upon you depends the outcome of the years I have spent in helping your school. That has been my real life's work, not my banking or my researches, but my first-hand organizing of human life." I saw him now, leaning toward the front seat, speaking with an intensity which had not been there before. It was hard not to turn my eyes from the highway and face him. "There is another reason. A reason more important, more passionate, and yes, even more sacred than all the others," he said, no longer seeming to see me, but speaking to himself alone. "Yes, even more sacred than all the others. A girl. My daughter. She was a being more rare, more beautiful, purer, more perfect, and more delicate than the wildest dream of a poet. I could never believe her to be my own flesh and blood. Her beauty was a wellspring of purest water of life, and to look upon her was to drink and drink and drink again. She was rare, a perfect creation,
a work of purest art, a delicate flower that bloomed in the liquid light of the moon, a nature not of this world, a personality like that of some biblical maiden, gracious and queenly, I found it difficult to believe her my own.
Suddenly he fumbled in his vest pocket and thrust something over the back of the seat, surprising me.
Here, young man, you owe much of your good fortune in attending such a school to her.
I looked upon the tinted miniature, framed in engraved platinum. I almost dropped it. A young woman of delicate, dreamy features looked up at me. She was very beautiful. I thought at the time so beautiful that I did not know whether I should express admiration to the extent I felt it or merely act polite. And yet I seemed to remember her, or someone like her, in the past. I know now that it was the flowing costume of soft, flimsy material that made for the effect. Today, dressed in one of the smart, well-tailored, angular, sterile, streamlined, engine-turned, air-conditioned, modern outfits you see in the women's magazines, she would appear as ordinary as an expensive piece of machine-tooled jewelry, and just as lifeless. Then, however, I shared something of his enthusiasm.
She was too pure for life, he said sadly. Too pure and too good and too beautiful. We were sailing together, touring the world, just she and I, when she became ill in Italy. I thought little of it at the time, and we continued across the Alps. When we reached Munich, she was already fading away. While we were attending an embassy party, she collapsed. The best medical science in the world could not save her. It was a lonely return, a bitter voyage. I have never recovered. I have never forgiven myself. Everything I've done since her passing has been a monument to her memory.
He became silent, looking with his blue eyes far beyond the field stretching away in the sun. I returned the miniature, wondering what in the world had made him open his heart to me. That was something I never did. It was dangerous. First, it was dangerous if you felt like that about anything, because then you'd never get it, or something or someone would take it away from you. Then it was dangerous because nobody would understand you, and they'd only laugh and think you were crazy.
So you see, young man, you are involved in my life quite intimately, even though you've never seen me before. You are bound to a great dream and to a beautiful monument. If you become a good farmer, a chef, a preacher, a doctor, singer, mechanic, whatever you become, and even if you fail, you are my fate, and you must write me and tell me the outcome.
I was relieved to see him smiling through the mirror. My feelings were mixed. Was he kidding me? Was he talking to me like someone in a book just to see how I would take it? Or could it be, I was almost afraid to think, that this rich man was just the tiniest bit crazy? How could I tell him his fate? He raised his head and our eyes met for an instant in the glass. Then I lowered mine to the blazing white line that divided the highway. The trees along the road were thick and tall. We took a curve. Flocks of quail sailed up and over a field, brown, brown, sailing down, blending. "Will you promise to tell me my fate?" I heard.
"Sir?
Will you?"
Right now, sir?"
I asked with embarrassment.
"It's up to you. Now, if you like."
I was silent. His voice was serious, demanding. I could think of no reply. The motor purred, an insect crushed itself against the windshield, leaving a yellow mucus smear.
"I don't know now, sir. This is only my junior year."
"But you'll tell me when you know."
"I'll try, sir."
"Good." When I took a quick glance into the mirror, he was smiling again. I wanted to ask him if being rich and famous and helping to direct the school to become what it was wasn't enough. But I was afraid.
"What do you think of my idea, young man?" he said.
I don't know, sir. I only think that you have what you're looking for. Because if I fail or leave school, it doesn't seem to me it would be your fault, because you helped make the school what it is.
And you think that enough?"
Yes, sir. That's what the president tells us. You have yours, and you got it yourself. And we have to lift ourselves up the same way.
But that's only part of it, young man. I have wealth and reputation and prestige. All that is true.
But your great founder had more than that. He had tens of thousands of lives dependent upon his ideas and upon his actions. What he did affected your whole race. In a way, he had the power of a king, or in a sense, of a god. That, I've come to believe, is more important than my own work, because more depends upon you. You are important because if you fail, I have failed by one individual, one defective cog. It didn't matter so much before, but now I'm growing old, and it has become very important.
But you don't even know my name, I thought, wondering what it was all about. I suppose it is difficult for you to understand how this concerns me, but as you develop, you must remember that I am dependent upon you to learn my fate. Through you and your fellow students, I become, let us say, 300 teachers, 700 trained mechanics, 800 skilled farmers, and so on. That way I can observe in terms of living personalities to what extent my money, my time, my hopes have been fruitfully invested. I also construct a living memorial to my daughter. Understand? I can see the fruits produced by the land that your great founder has transformed from barren clay to fertile soil. His voice ceased, and I saw the strands of pale blue smoke drifting across the mirror and heard the electric lighter snap back on its cable into place behind the back of the seat.
I think I understand you better now, sir, I said.
Very good, my boy.
Shall I continue in this direction, sir?
By all means, he said, looking out at the countryside. I've never seen this section before. It's new territory for me. Half-consciously, I followed the white line as I drove, thinking about what he had said. Then, as we took a hill, we were swept by a wave of scorching air, and it was as though we were approaching a desert. It almost took my breath away, and I leaned over and switched on the fan, hearing its sudden whir. Thank you, he said as a slight breeze filled the car. We were passing a collection of shacks and log cabins now, bleached white and warped by the weather. Sun-tortured shingles lay on the roofs like decks of water-soaked cards spread out to dry. The houses consisted of two square rooms joined together by a common floor and roof with a porch in between. As we passed, we could look through to the fields beyond. I stopped the car at his excited command in front of a house set off from the rest.
Is that a log cabin?
It was an old cabin with its chinks filled with chalk-white clay, with bright new shingles patching its roof. Suddenly I was sorry that I had blundered down this road. I recognized the place as soon as I saw the group of children in stiff new overalls who played near a rickety fence.
Yes, sir, it is a log cabin, I said.
It was the cabin of Jim Trueblood, a sharecropper who had brought disgrace upon the black community. Several months before, he had caused quite a bit of outrage up at the school, and now his name was never mentioned above a whisper. Even before that, he had seldom come near the campus, but had been well-liked as a hard worker who took good care of his family's needs, and as one who told the old stories with a sense of humor and a magic that made them come alive. He was also a good tenor singer, and sometimes when special white guests visited the school, he was brought up along with the members of a country quartet to sing what the officials called their primitive spirituals when we assembled in the chapel on Sunday evenings. We were embarrassed by the earthy harmonies they sang, but since the visitors were awed, we dared not laugh at the crude, high, plaintively animal sounds Jim Trueblood made as he led the quartet. That had all passed now with his disgrace, and what on the part of the school officials had been an attitude of contempt blunted by tolerance had now become a contempt sharpened by hate. I didn't understand in those pre-invisible days that their hate, and mine too, was charged with fear. How all of us at the college hated the black belt people, the peasants, during those days. We were trying to lift them up, and they, like Trueblood, did everything it seemed to pull us down.
It appears quite old, Mr. Norton said, looking across the bare, hard stretch of yard where two women dressed in new blue and white checked ginghams were washing clothes in an iron pot. The pot was soot black,
and the feeble flames that licked its sides showed pale pink and bordered with black like flames in mourning. Both women moved with the weary, full-fronted motions of far-gone pregnancy.
"It is, sir," I said. "That one and the other two like it were built during slavery times."
"You don't say. I would have never believed that they were so enduring."
"Since slavery times?"
"That's true, sir. And the white family that owned the land when it was a big plantation still lives in town."
"Yes," he said. "I know that many of the old families still survive, and individuals, too. The human stock goes on, even though it degenerates. But these cabins..."
He seemed surprised and confounded. "Do you suppose those women know anything about the age and history of the place? The older one looks as though she might."
I doubt it, sir. They don't seem very bright."
"Bright?" he said, removing his cigar. "You mean that they wouldn't talk with me?" he said suspiciously.
"Yes, sir, that's it."
"Why not?" I didn't want to explain. It made me feel ashamed, but he sensed that I knew something and pressed me.
It's not very nice, sir, but I don't think those women would talk to us."
"We can explain that we were from the school. Surely they'll talk then. You may tell them who I am."
"Yes, sir," I said, "but they hate us up at the school. They never come there."
"What?"
"No, sir."
"And those children along the fence down there?"
"They don't either, sir."
"But why?"
I don't really know, sir. Quite a few folks out this way don't, though. I guess they're too ignorant. They're not interested."
"But I can't believe it."
The children had stopped playing and now looked silently at the car, their arms behind their backs and their new oversized overalls pulled tight over their little pot bellies as though they too were pregnant.
"What about their menfolk?"
I hesitated.
Why did he find this so strange?
"He hates us, sir," I said.
"You say he? Aren't both the women married?" I caught my breath. I'd made a mistake.
"The old one is, sir," I said reluctantly.
"What happened to the young woman's husband?"
"She, doesn't have any. That is, I..."
"What is it, young man? Do you know these people?"
"Only a little, sir. There was, some talk about them up on the campus a while back."
"What talk?"
"Well, the young woman is the old woman's daughter."
"And?"
"Well, sir, they say... You see, I mean, they say the daughter doesn't have a husband."
"Oh, I see. But that shouldn't be so strange. I understand that your people..." "Never mind. Is that all?"
"Well, sir..."
"Yes? What else?"
"They say that her father did it."
"What?"
"Yes, sir, that he gave her the baby."
I heard the sharp intake of breath like a toy balloon suddenly deflated. His face reddened. I was confused, feeling shame for the two women and fear that I had talked too much and offended his sensibilities. "And did anyone from the school investigate this matter?" he asked at last.
"Yes, sir," I said.
"What was discovered?"
"That it was true, they say."
"But how does he explain his doing such a monstrous thing?" He sat back in the seat, his hands grasping his knees, his knuckles bloodless. I looked away, down the heat-dazzling concrete of the highway. I wished we were back on the other side of the white line, heading back to the quiet green stretch of the campus. "It is said that the man took both his wife and his daughter?"
"Yes, sir."
"And that he is the father of both their children?"
"Yes, sir."
"No. No. No." He sounded as though he were in great pain. I looked at him anxiously. What had happened? What had I said? "Not that. No," he said with something like horror. I saw the sun blaze upon the new blue overalls as the man appeared around the cabin. His shoes were tan and new, and he moved easily over the hot earth. He was a small man, and he covered the yard with a familiarity that would have allowed him to walk in the blackest darkness with the same certainty. He came and said something to the woman as he fanned himself with a blue bandana handkerchief, but they appeared to regard him sullenly, barely speaking, and hardly looking in his direction. Would that be the man? Mr. Norton asked.
Yes, sir. I think so.
Get out, he cried. I must talk with him. I was unable to move. I felt surprise and a dread and resentment of what he might say to True Blood and his women, the questions he might ask. Why couldn't he leave them alone? Hurry! I climbed from the car and opened the rear door. He clambered out and almost ran across the road to the yard, as though compelled by some pressing urgency which I could not understand. Then suddenly I saw the two women turn and run frantically behind the house, their movements heavy and flat-footed. I hurried behind him, seeing him stop when he reached the man and the children. They became silent, their faces clouding over, their features becoming soft and negative, their eyes bland and deceptive. They were crouching behind their eyes, waiting for him to speak, just as I recognized that I was trembling behind my own. Up close, I saw what I had not seen from the car. The man had a scar on his right cheek, as though he had been hit in the face with a sledge. The wound was raw and moist, and from time to time he lifted his handkerchief to fan away the gnats.
I, Mr. Norton stammered. I must talk with you.
All right, sir,
Jim Trueblood said without surprise and waited.
Is it true? I mean, did you?
Sir?
Trueblood asked, as I looked away.
You have survived?
He blurted.
But is it true?
Sir?
The farmer said, his brow wrinkling with bewilderment.
I'm sorry, sir, I said, but I don't think he understands you.
He ignored me, staring into Trueblood's face as though reading a message there which I could not perceive.
You did and are unharmed,
he shouted, his blue eyes blazing into the black face with something like envy and indignation. Trueblood looked helplessly at me. I looked away. I understood no more than he.
You have looked upon chaos and are not destroyed.
No, sir. I feels all right.
You do. You feel no inner turmoil, no need to cast out the offending eye.
Sir?
Answer me.
I'm all right, sir,
Trueblood said uneasily.
My eye is all right, too. And when I feels poorly in my gut, I takes a little soda and it goes away.
No, no, no. Let us go where there is shade, he said, looking about excitedly and going swiftly to where the porch cast a swath of shade.
We followed him. The farmer placed his hand on my shoulder, but I shook it off, knowing that I could explain nothing. We sat on the porch in a semicircle in camp chairs, me between the sharecropper and the millionaire. The earth around the porch was hard and white, from where wash water had long been thrown.
How are you faring now? Mr. Norton asked.
Perhaps I could help.
We ain't doing so bad, sir. Before they heard about what happened to us out here, I couldn't get no help from nobody. Now a lot of folks is curious and goes out of their way to help. Even the biggity school folks up on the hill, only there was a catch to it. They offered to send us clean out of the county, pay our way and everything, and give me $100 to get settled with. But we likes it here, so I told them no. Then they sent a fellow out here, a big fellow too, and he said if I didn't leave, they was going to turn the white folks loose on me. Made me mad, and it made me scared. Them folks up there to the school is in strong with white folks, and that scared me. But I thought when they first come out here that they was different from when I went up there a long time ago looking for some book learning and some points on how to handle my crops. That was when I had my own place. I thought they was trying to help me on account I got two women due to birth about the same time. But I got mad when I found they was trying to get rid of us because they said we was a disgrace. Yes, sir, I got real mad. So I went down to see Mr. Buchanan, the boss man. I told him about it. And he give me a note to the sheriff and told me to take it to him. I did that just like he told me. I went to the jailhouse and give Sheriff Barber the note, and he asked me to tell him what happened. And I told him, and he called in some more men, and they made me tell it again. They wanted to hear about the gal lots of times, and they give me something to eat and drink and some tobacco. Surprised me, because I was scared and expecting something different. Well,
I guess there ain't a colored man in the county who ever got to take so much of the white folks' time as I did. So finally, they tell me not to worry, that they was going to send word up to the school that I was to stay right where I am. Them big niggas didn't bother me neither. It just goes to show you that no matter how biggity a nigga gets, the white folks can always cut him down. The white folks took up for me. And white folks took to coming out here to see us and talk with us. Some of them was big white folks, too, from the big school way across the state. Asked me lots about what I thought about things and about my folks and the kids and wrote it all down in a book. Ha! But best of all, sir, I got more work now than I ever did have before.
He talked willingly now with a kind of satisfaction and no trace of hesitancy or shame. The old man listened with a puzzled expression as he held an unlit cigar in his delicate fingers.
Things is pretty good now, the farmer said. Every time I think of how cold it was and what a hard time we was having, I gets the shakes.
I saw him bite into a plug of chewing tobacco. Something tinkled against the porch and I picked it up, gazing at it from time to time. It was a hard red apple, stamped out of tin.
You see, sir, it was cold and us didn't have much fire. Nothing but wood, no coal. I tried to get help, but wouldn't nobody help us, and I couldn't find no work or nothing. It was so cold, all of us had to sleep together, me, the old lady, and the gal. That's how it started, sir.
He cleared his throat, his eyes gleaming and his voice taking on a deep, incantatory quality, as though he had told the story many, many times. Flies and fine white gnats swarmed about his wound.
That's the way it was, he said. Me on one side and the old lady on the other and the gal in the middle. It was dark, plum black. Black as the middle of a bucket of tar. The kids were sleeping all together in their bed over in the corner. I must have been the last one to go to sleep because I was thinking about how to get some grub for the next day and about the gal and the young boy what was starting to hang around her. I didn't like him, and he kept coming through my thoughts, and I made up my mind to warn him away from the gal. It was black dark. And I heard one of the kids whimper in his sleep, and the last few sticks of kindling crackling and settling in the stove, and the smell of the fat meat seemed to get cold and still in the air, just like meat grease when it gets set in a cold plate of molasses. And I was thinking about the gal and this boy, and feeling her arms beside me, and hearing the old lady snoring with a kind of moaning and a groaning on the other side. I was worrying about my family, how they was going to eat and all, and I thought about when the guy was little, like the young'un sleeping over in the corner, and how I was her favorite over the old lady. There we was, breathing together in the dark. Only I could see him in my mind, knowing him like I do. In my mind, I looked at all of them one by one. The gal looks just like the old lady did when she was young, and I first met her, only better looking. You know, we getting to be a better looking race of people. Anyway, I could hear him breathing, and though I hadn't been, it made me sleepy. Then I heard the gal say, "Daddy," soft and low in her sleep, and I looked, trying to see if she was still awake. But all I can do is smell her and feel her breath on my hand when I go to touch her. She said it so soft I couldn't be sure I had heard anything, so I just laid there listening. Seems like I heard a whippoorwill calling, and I thought to myself, "Go on away from here. We'll whip old Will when we find him." Then I heard the clock up there at the school striking four times. Lonesome like. Then I got to thinking about way back when I left the farm and went to live in Mobile, and about a gal I had me then. Oh, I was young then. Like this young fella here. Us lived in a two-story house alongside the river, and at night in the summertime we used to lay in bed and talk, and after she'd gone off to sleep I'd be awake looking out at the lights coming up from the water and listening to the sounds of the boats moving along. They used to have musicians on them boats, and sometimes I used to wake her up to hear the music when they come up the river. I'd be laying there and it would be quiet, and I could hear it coming from way, way off, like when you quail hunting and it's getting dark and you can hear the boss bird whistling, trying to get the cover together again. He's coming toward you slow and whistling soft because he knows you somewhere around with your gun. Still, he got to round him up, so he keeps on coming. Them boss quails is like a good man. What he got to do, he do. Well, that's the way the boats used to sound, coming close to you from far away. First one would be coming to you when you almost sleep, and it sounded like somebody hitting at you with a big shiny pick. You see the pick point coming straight at you, coming slow, too, and you can't dodge. Only when it goes to hit you, it ain't no pick at all, but somebody far away breaking little bottles of all kinds of colored glass. It's still coming at you, though. Still coming. Then you hear it close up, like when you up in the second-story window and look down on a wagon full of watermelons, and you see one of them young, juicy melons split wide open, laying all spread out and cool and sweet on top of all the striped green ones, like it's waiting just for you, so you can see how red and ripe and juicy it is, and all the shiny black seeds it's got and all. You could hear the side wheels splashing like they don't want to wake nobody up. And us, me and the gal, we lay there feeling like we was rich folks. And them boys in the boats would be playing sweet as good peach brandy wine. Then the boats be passing, and lights would be gone from the window, and the music would be going too. Kind of like when you watch a gal in a red dress and a wide straw hat going past you down a lane with the trees on both sides, and she's plump and juicy and kind of switching her tail because she knows you watching, and you know she know, and you just stands there and watches till you can't see nothing but the top of her red hat, and then that goes. And you know she done dropped behind a hill. I seen me a guy like that once. All I could hear then would be that Mobile gal, name of Margaret. She'd be breathing beside me, and maybe by that time she'd say, "Daddy, you still wait?" And then I'd grunt, and drop on off. Jammins, Jim Trueblood said, "I likes to recall them Mobile days." Well, it was like that when I heard Mattie Lou say, "Daddy." And I knowed she must have been dreaming about somebody from the way she said it. And I gets mad wondering if it's that boy. I listen to her mumbling for a while, trying to hear if she calls his name, but she don't. And I remember that they say if you put the hand of a person who's talking in his sleep in warm water, he'll say it all. But the water's too cold, and I wouldn't have done it anyway. But I'm realizing that she's a woman now. When I feels her turn and squirm against me and throw her arm across my neck, up where the cover didn't reach and I was cold. She said something I couldn't understand, like a woman says when she wants to tease and please a man. I knowed then she was grown, and I wondered how many times it had done happen. And was it that doggone boy? I moved her arm, and it was soft. But it didn't wake her, so I called her. But that didn't wake her neither. Then I turned my back and tried to move away, though there wasn't much room, and I could still feel her touching me, moving close to me. Then I must have dropped into the dream. I have to tell you about that dream. I looked at Mr. Norton and stood up, thinking that now was a good time to leave. But he was listening to True Blood so intensely he didn't see me. And I sat down again, cursing the farmer silently. To hell with his dream. I don't quite remember it all, but I remember that I was looking for some fat meat. I went to the white folks downtown, and they said to go see Mr. Broadnax and that he'd give it to me. Well, he lives up on a hill, and I was climbing up there to see him. Seems like that was the highest hill in the world. The more I climb, the farther away Mr. Broadnax's house seems to get. But finally, I do reach there. And I'm so tired and restless to get to the man, I goes through the front door. Now, I knows it's wrong, but I can't help it. I goes in, and I'm standing in a big room full of lighted candles and shiny furniture and pictures on the wall and soft stuff on the floor, but I don't see a living soul. So I calls his name. But still don't nobody come and don't nobody answer. So I sees the door, and goes through that door, and I'm in a big white bedroom, like I seen one time when I was a little old boy and went to the big house with my ma. Everything in the room was white, and I'm standing there knowing I got no business in there, but there anyhow. It's a woman's room, too. I tries to get out, but I can't find the door. And all around me, I can smell woman. I can smell it getting stronger all the time. Then it looks over in the corner and sees one of them tall grandfather clocks, and I hears it striking. And the glass door is opening, and a white lady is stepping out of it. She got on a nightgown of soft, white, silky stuff and nothing else. And she looks straight at me. I don't know what to do. I wants to run, but the only door I see is the one in the clock she's standing in. And anyway, I can't move, and this here clock is keeping up a heap of racket. It's getting faster and faster all the time. I tries to say something, but I can't. Then she starts to scream, and I thinks I done gone deep, 'cause though I can see her mouth working, I don't hear nothing. Yet I can still hear the clock, and I tries to tell her I'm just looking for Mr. Broadnax, but she don't hear me. Instead, she runs up, grabs me around the neck, and holds tight, trying to keep me out of the clock. I don't know what to do then. Sure enough, I tries to talk to her, I tries to get away, but she's holding me, and I'm scared to touch her, 'cause she's white. Then I get so scared that I throws her on the bed and tries to break her hold. That woman just seemed to sink out of sight. That there bed was so soft. It's sinking down so far, I think it's gonna smother both of us. Then swoosh, all of a sudden a flock of little white geese flies out of the bed like they say you see when you go to dig for buried money. Lord! They had no more and disappeared than I heard a door open, and Mr. Broadnax's voice said, "They just niggers. Leave them do it." How can he tell this to white men, I thought, when he knows they'll say that all Negroes do such things? I looked at the floor, a red mist of anguish before my eyes. And I can't stop. Although I got a feeling something is wrong, I get loose from the woman now, and I'm running for the clock. At first, I couldn't get the door open. It had some kind of crinkly stuff like steel wool on the facing. But I gets it open and gets inside, and it's hot and dark in there. I goes up a dark tunnel up near where the machinery is making all that noise and heat. It's like the power plant they got up through the school. It's burning hot, as if in the house was caught on fire. And I starts to run and trying to get out. I runs and runs till I should be tired, but ain't tired, but feeling more rested as I runs. And running so good, it's like flying. And I'm flying and sailing and floating right up over the town. Only I'm still in the tunnel. Then way up ahead, I sees a bright light like a jack-o'-lantern over a graveyard. It gets brighter and brighter, and I know I got to catch up with it or else. Then all of a sudden, I was right up with it, and it burst like a great big electric light in my eyes and scalded me all over. Only it wasn't a scald, but like I was drowning in a lake where the water was hot on the top and had cold, numbing currents down under it. Then all at once, I'm through it, and I'm relieved to be out and in the cool daylight again. I wakes up intending to tell the old lady about my crazy dream. Morning done coming, it's getting almost light, and now I am looking straight in Maddie Lou's face, as she's beating me and scratching and trembling and shaking and crying all at the same time like she's having a fit. I'm too surprised to move. She's crying, "Daddy, Daddy, oh, Daddy, Daddy," just like that. And all at once, I remember the old lady. She's right beside us snoring, and I can't move because I figures if I moved, it would be a sin. And I figures, too, that if I don't move, it maybe ain't no sin because it happened when I was asleep, although maybe sometimes a man can look at a little old pigtail gal and see him a whole way, you know all that. Anyway, I realize that if I don't move, the old lady will see me. I don't want that to happen. That would be worse than sin. I'm whispering to Maddie Little, trying to keep her quiet, and I'm figuring how to get myself out of the fix I'm in without sinning. I almost chokes her. But once a man gets himself in a tight spot like that, there ain't much he can do. It ain't up to him no longer. There I was, trying to get away with all my might, yet having to move without moving. I flew in, but I had to walk out. I had to move without moving. I done thought about it since a heap. And when you think right hard, you see that that's the way things has always been with me. That's just about being my life. There was only one way I can figure that I could get out. That was with a knife. But I didn't have no knife. And if y'all ever seen them gill them young boar pigs in the fall, you know I knowed that that was too much to pay to keep from sinning. Everything was happening inside of me like a fight was going on. Then just the very thought of the fix I'm in puts the iron back in me. Then if that ain't bad enough, Matty Lou can't hold out no longer and gets to moving herself. First she was trying to push me away, and I'm trying to hold her down to keep from sinning. That I'm pulling away and shushing her to be quiet so as not to wake her ma. When she grabs Holt to me and holds tight, she didn't want me to go then. And to tell the honest to God truth, I found out that I didn't want to go neither. I guess I felt then at that time, and although I've been sorry since, just about like that fellow did down in Birmingham. That one what locked himself in his house and shot at them police until they set fire to the house and burned him up. I was lost. The more wriggling and twisting we done trying to get away, the more we wanted to stay. So like that fellow, I stayed. I had to fight it on out to the end. He might have died, but I suspect now that he got a heap of satisfaction before he went. I know there ain't nothing like what I went through. I can't tell how it was. It's like when a real drinking man gets drunk. Or like when a real sanctified religious woman gets so worked up she jumps out of her clothes. Or when a real gambler man keeps on gambling when he's losing. You got Holt to it, and you can't let go even though you want to. Mr. Norton, sir, I said in a choked voice, it's time we were getting back to the campus. You'll miss your appointments. He didn't even look at me. Please, he said, waving his hand in annoyance. Trueblood seemed to smile at me behind his eyes as he looked from the white man to me and continued. I couldn't even let go when I heard Kate scream. It was a scream to make your blood run cold. It sounds like a woman who's watching a team of wild horses run down her baby child and can't move. Kate's hair is standing up like she done seen a ghost. Her gown is hanging open and the veins in her neck is about to bust. And her eyes, Lord, them eyes. I'm looking up at her from where I'm laying on the pallet with Matty Lou, and I'm too weak to move. She screams and starts to picking up the first thing that comes to her hand and throwing it. Some of them misses me, and some of them hits me. Little things and big things. Something cold and strong stinking hits me and wets me and bangs against my head. Something hits the wall. Boom-a-loom-a-loom, like a cannonball, and I tries to cover up my head. Kate's talking the unknown tongue like a wild woman. Wait a minute, Kate, I says, stop it. Then I hears her stop a second, and I hears her running across the floor, and I twists and I looks, and Lord, she done got my double barrel shotgun. And while she foaming at the mouth and cocking the gun, she gets her speech. Get up! Get up, she say. Hey, no, Kate, I says, God damn your soul to hell, get up off my child. Oh, but woman, Kate, listen, don't talk, move, down that thing, Kate, no, down, up. Then there's buckshot, that there's buckshot, woman, buckshot, yes it is, down it, I say, I'm gonna blast your soul to hell. You gonna hit Matty Lou, not Matty Lou, you, it spreads, Kate, Matty Lou. She's moving around, aiming at me. I done warned you, Jim. Kate, it was a dream. Listen to me. You the one who listened up from there. She jerks the gun and I shuts my eyes. But instead of thunder and lightning busting me, I hears Matty Lou scream in my ear. Mama, oh, mama. I rolls over. Then Kate hesitates. She looks at the gun and she looks at us and she shivers. A minute, like she got the fever. Then all at once, she drops the gun, and zip. Quick as the cat, she turns and grabs something off the stove. It catches me like somebody digging into my side with a sharp spade. I can't breathe. She's throwing and talking all at the same time. And when I looks up, man, she's got an iron in her hand. I hollers, oh, no blood, Kate. Don't spill no blood. You low down dog, she says. It's better to spill than to foul. No, Kate, things ain't what they appear. Don't make no blood sin on account of no dream sin. Shut up, nigga. You done fouled. But I sees there ain't no use reasoning with her then. I makes up my mind that I'm going to take whatever she give me. It seems to me that all I can do is take my punishment. I tell myself, maybe if you suffer for it, it will be best. Maybe you owe it to Kate to let her beat you. You ain't guilty, but she thinks you is. You don't want her to beat you, but she thinks she got to beat you. You want to get up, but you too weak to move. I was, too. I was frozen to where I was like a youngin' what done stuck his lips to a pump handle in the wintertime. I was just like a jaybird that the yellow jacket's done stung till he's paralyzed, but still alive in his eyes, and he's watching him sting his body to death.
It made me seem to go way back, a distance in my head, behind my eyes, like I was standing behind a windbreak during a storm. I looks out and sees Kate running toward me, dragging something behind her. I tries to see what it is, because I'm curious about it, and sees her gown catch on the stove and her hand coming inside with something in it. I thinks to myself, it's a handle. What she got the handle to? Then I sees her right up on me, big. She's swinging her arms like a man swinging a 10-pound sledge, and I see the knuckles of her hand is bruised and bleeding, and I see it catching her gown, and I see her gown go up, and so I can see her thigh, and I sees how rusty and gray the cold done made her skin, and I sees her bend and straighten up, and I hears her grunt, and I sees her swing, and smells her